Good morning. I'm Jay Barrett, and this is the Kenai Conversation. And today we're going to talk about the forest and the trees, or the trees and the forest. We're going to see if we can see both of them, or see all of them, or see the forest for the trees. I have guests who are experts in all of the above with me here today. John Morton, supervisory fish and wildlife biologist with the Kenai National Wildlife Refuge. Hello.
Hi.
How's it
going? Glad to be here. Thanks.
Oh, thank you. And then Hans Rinke, Kenai Kodiak Area Forester with the Alaska Division of Forestry. Hi.
Good morning, Jay.
Oh, why don't you move that mic a little closer to you? It's, you can move the mic. You don't have to yourself.
Good morning.
So, Kenai Kodiak Area Forester.
You bet. Yep. Kenai Peninsula, Kodiak Chain of Islands. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, that's why your name is familiar to me. I've interviewed you before.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Certainly could be. Yeah.
Yeah. About forest things in Kodiak.
You bet. Sure.
When they catch on fire or other things.
Yeah. Yeah. You bet.
So we're here talking about the trees and the forest and a little bit. Maybe first, you guys could tell our listeners a little bit about your job specifically, and then how it interacts with all the trees out there here on the Kenai Peninsula that everybody sees every day, and how you guys interact with, or your agencies interact with each other. Who wants to go first?
I can start things off, Jay.
All right, go for it.
I work for the Alaskan Division of Forestry, and we have two main programs that the public's probably aware of. That's the Wildland Fire Prevention and Protection Program and our Traditional Forest Resources Program. Wildland Fire Prevention and Protection is just that, protection of public property and resources from the threat of wildland fire, and also education regarding wildland fire. And our traditional resources, or forest management side of our program, is managing state land for timber resources and also administering state statutes on private lands when timber harvest is occurring. So protecting water quality and fish habitat on those private lands.
Okay.
Yeah, and I'm the supervisory biologist, you know, at the Kenai Refuge, and most of the work we do, of course, is wildlife-oriented, but when we do work with trees and forests, you know, it's in the context of wildlife and their distribution and how they use trees, and that's kind of, we're coming at it from a little bit different way than Hans is. And so we do a lot of research, both some real basic research in terms of things like historical mean fire return intervals for the different hardwoods and softwoods, and then we look at things like spruce bark beetle outbreaks and those kinds of things.
Mm-hmm. How many different agencies are there that have their I was going to say iron in the fire, but I'm not going to talk about fire and trees right yet. How many different agencies on the Kenai Peninsula are involved in managing our wooded lands?
That's a pretty broad question. I would, just off the top of my head, I would say probably a dozen. That would be governmental and non-governmental that, you know, my agency or I probably work with on certainly more than an annual basis. Kenai National Wildlife Refuge being a large one, and then the U.S. Forest Service being another large one here on the Kenai Peninsula, the majority landowners on the Kenai Peninsula. But pretty broad spectrum here on the Kenai, which is it's a good interagency group for land management here.
What are some of the smaller ones?
Some of the smaller ones would be some of our native landowners here on the Kenai Peninsula, native land holdings. State parks would be another smaller one, a landholder, but you know, not the acreage certainly of some of our federal counterparts.
Mm-hmm. Well, on the fire side, I know you work with Siri and the Nilchik Native Association. Those are some of the big ones, right?
Yep, those would be some of the bigger, larger native land ownerships, certainly.
Mm-hmm. Hans, can I ask you to maybe move the microphone closer to you?
Okay, try this again.
Yeah, I know the chair only goes so close, and I don't want you banging your knees. You're a tall fella there.
How's that? Is that better?
That is much better.
Okay, thank you.
Just, we got this loud amplifier. I don't know if you can hear it.
Yeah,
back
I can hear the fan back there.
But the louder we are, the less people hear that. So I have it nailed, I tell you that. So you work with, as John was saying here, we work with other groups in fires. Are you the guy who coordinates fire response then?
Yeah, so in a broad sense, that'd certainly be a large part of my job is not the direct suppression of those fires. That's something that our staff does here at the area, but the coordination on a landowner level to making sure that the landowners have input, obviously, on what's occurring on their land ownership while the state may be engaged in suppression activities.
Oh, okay. I recall, I don't know, 15 years ago, there was a program around the Kenai Peninsula called FireWise.
Yeah.
And they were trying real hard to make sure that the, they called it the rural interface.
Ooh, the wildlife urban interface. Yeah.
Yeah. Was cleared and, you know, everybody was FireWise.
Sure. That, that's a large part of our education piece is the... you know, educating the public on defensible space, as we call it, within the WUI, the Wildland Urban Interface, and that's the immediate zone around your home that, you know, you may manipulate vegetation or have maintenance activities within that area to, you know, reduce the threat of wildfire to your property. So we have had grant funding over the years to actually pay for portions of that work to be completed. At this time, we do not have any, but we still maintain the educational piece of that, certainly educating the public or individuals on how they can do that, or on a, you know, sometimes on a broader, more community level, a subdivision type level of, you know, education or getting multiple landowners together to discuss that and to implement that on their property.
Hans, you might mention the All Lands, All Hands group.
Oh, yeah. It's a good point, John, that, as John mentions, the All Lands, All Hands group, it's an interagency land management group that, meets twice a year, and basically the intent of that group is to just coordinate efforts broadly to make sure that everyone's aware of what other agencies are doing and when possible to, you know, leverage our resources for cross-boundary projects, you know, cross-land ownership projects. So.
And not just forest fires, other projects.
You bet.
About.
Correct. Yep. So, you know, the group's kind of the bookends is our fire management, but that covers vegetation management in between that, certainly. So, we've had vegetation management projects, multi-agency projects the last few years. The Funny River fuel break being one in 2012 or 13. The Sterling fuel break being another one. Just. Year and a half ago that are projects across multiple jurisdictions and with multiple funding sources that have kind of been the brainchild of that group.
Oh, it sounds like there's not much in the way of interagency, rivalry or stuff like that, turf wars of any kind? Or?
Not in my time here. It's certainly an all-hands-on-deck approach, fun environment to work in, very rewarding.
Wow. Let me ask you about wildfire in a more immediate sense. How are things looking this year? As because breakup has happened very quickly this year, in my opinion, and a quick green up is usually not that conducive to keeping things from burning.
You bet. I can kind of speak broadly and narrow it down. You know, on a statewide scale, that the prediction is for about an average fire season, and that's statewide about 1 million acres a year burned. You know, it's been about a 50-50 is my guess whether those predictions hold true into the actual fire season here. Those are early season predictions, but we've whether breakup's early or not is hard to tell. It varies across the Kenai. I'd say we're probably somewhere in the middle here on average, I believe, but you know, the start of fire season on the Kenai Peninsula here is really defined by the when fuels all are available to burn here. It's not when, you know, other parts of the lower 48, et cetera, have, they get green up and that green up dries out and then they have fire season. And for us here, it's as soon as that snow is removed and that grass is available, we're in fire season. So, you know, we've had a few wildland fires here already on the Kenai Peninsula, southern Kenai Peninsula, one on Kodiak Island. And so,
wait, you know, this spring, you mean?
Correct. Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah. This spring. So, and that's not unusual to start having these, you know, fires in mid to late April. That's as soon as that snow, most of Homer was snow free for most of the winter, all winter. So, you know, we'll see the bulk of fire activity pick up here in the Kenai in May is our busiest month here with, initial attack and tapering off as we actually get green up. you know, into kind of that middle June or certainly into early July period. So, you know, by the 4th of July, when you're wearing your raincoat at the 4th of July parade, our fire season's typically tapered off. You're not always the case every year, but, you know, May and June are certainly our busiest months.
I was going to say that when you say it's not unusual for the spring fires, I mean, that's still a fairly recent event. When you say it's unusual, it's not unusual in the last, really since the early 2000s. I mean, these spring fires, I mean, the window, what's changed is that window is that we don't have the snowpack that we used to have. And so when that snowpack comes off, as Hans was saying, the grass is dry and it's available to burn. And there's a window there where the ground is still frozen, and the grass is dry, and then you add in humid ignition, and then that's what causes the, you know, these spring grassland fires. And it was that 2005 fire down there in Tracy Avenue fire that almost burned down Homer in 2005, and that literally changed the prompted the state legislature to change the official start of the fire season for Alaska from May 1 to April 1.
Yeah, we've certainly the last, I've been here, it's my 10th season, so I can't speak for too far back in history, but we have certainly staffed, you know, earlier, a month earlier now than we would have maybe 15 years ago, you know, just recognizing that two things, more grass now and less snow. And so John would be more aware of this than I am, but I just had saw a presentation a few weeks ago, some NASA study looking at aerial photographs over the years, and the Kenai Peninsula has lost somewhere in the neighborhood of 20 to 30 days less snow-free than it used to be. I don't know how accurate that is, but certainly that leads to more availability of fuels, which means fire season is here sooner.
Yeah, it gets moved back earlier and earlier.
Huh. Yeah, that makes sense. What does it mean, or does it mean anything for the back end? For the back end of the season, is it staying wetter longer, or are there?
Well, the rainy season has changed a little bit. We tend to get more precipitation now in the late summer, so it has dampened a little bit. But from the standpoint of fire management, you know, on the refuge, which is 2 million acres and a big chunk of the Western Peninsula, I mean, for a lot of the fires that are starting out in the refuge, we want it to burn. I mean, you know, that's part of the natural fire cycle. But obviously, we don't want to burn down communities. And the difference is if a fire starts in mid to late summer, we're more likely to let it burn because you're running into the fall, right? The problem is with these spring fires, and first of all, they're really flammable. They're highly flammable.
Correct.
And they're typically close to the urban interface. And the bottom line is, as soon as they start, you need to put them out. You can't be messing with them.
Yeah, and ecologically, the early fire season is a pretty, you know, you essentially perpetuate the grass cycle with these early fires, as John talked about. You get these early fires, the ground is frozen. You know, this grass we have here can be killed with deep burning fires and burning its root mass, but that doesn't occur with these early fires we have, and so you just kind of perpetuate that grass vegetation state and, you know, ecologically kind of a pause button.
Interesting. You know, that's a good segue into the article that, John, you wrote for the Clarion here. I think it was last year or the year before. Refuge Notebook, Surprising Trees Grow on the Kenai Peninsula. It was last year, exactly a year ago almost, April 27th. And in it, you write that you were enjoying a music festival, and you looked up, and there was a maple tree was staring at you?
Yeah, that's right. And that kind of shocked me because, you know, we think, on the refuge, we think a lot about different trees, both as exotic trees and invasive trees. And I got to back up just a little bit, you know, in response to that, you know, it's kind of, we were talking about the grassland piece, and in response to that, state forestry has taken a very active role in promoting replanting of trees to try to kind of get rid of that grassland interface, because that's high risk, you know, very flammable. But from my perspective, coming from sort of the natural side of life, you know, over the years, they've kind of promoted trees that are not native to the Kenai. So things like lodgepole pine and scotch pine some other trees. And I've, in the past, I have to say that I've not been that fond of the fact that we have these non-native trees that are being planted. But in more recent times, I've really started to change my perspective on it, mostly because of the climate change thought process, you know, that we know trees are moving northward. And so at this point, I'm a little bit more receptive to it. So when I saw this maple growing down there at Soldotna Creek Park, planted by City Parks, I was kind of stunned, not in a bad way, more like, wow, I didn't know maples grew here, right? And so that kind of prompted me to do sort of an urban forestry inventory. I started poking around. You know, I got a hold of some people in Seward and some people in Homer and the Central Peninsula Garden Club and the Homer Garden Club kind of helped me out with some of their members and really in City of Soldotna and really started kind of poking around to see what was growing here.
Well, you know, and it's amazing. The list of trees that you have here, balsam, cottonwood, two different kind of cottonwoods, a couple of hemlocks. But the lodgepole pine really was what struck me because I think the only time I've ever seen that was in North Carolina. I mean, I didn't even know it was a tree that could grow in Alaska. You mentioned the zones we have here. We're in a zone, what is it, 4A or 5A?
Well, in Soldotna proper here, yeah.
Yeah. You know, which is pretty chilly. How are these trees, how are they doing? You can plant a tree, but how is it propagating?
Well, you know, there's a couple of things going on here. One is, you know, obviously in an urban environment, when you're close to a building or a house, it's warmer. Everybody knows that. So if you stick a tree in the ground close to your house, it's much more likely to survive. So that's one issue. But then the other issue is it is getting warmer here and people know it. And, the growing season for the Kenai Peninsula, you know, the Scenarios Network for Alaska Planning, which is a UAF group, and they do a lot of modeling, and they've looked at the climate, and they say that on the Kenai Peninsula, by the end of the century, we're going to have an additional month of growing season.
Yeah, I wouldn't disagree with that, and I think certainly the change in climate and also more cultivars of cold hardy trees. You know, they're modifying trees now to grow in colder temperature, you know, broader spectrum of temperatures. So I think that's kind of the certainly the reason why you're maybe 20 years ago you'd see lodgepole pine and Siberian larch here, and now you see ash and oak and some maple and all these kind of what you might consider oddities planted in some urban settings or in microsites.
Oh wow, there's an oak tree somewhere.
Yeah, I have. I couldn't specifically tell you where on the Kenai Peninsula, but I know that we have actually given some out at the fair recently in the last few years, and folks have had success growing those in different parts of the Kenai Peninsula.
Wow.
Yeah, I've got, I documented red and bur oaks, and bur oaks kind of surprised me because I think of them as something that you might find more down in the, closer to the Great Plains. Green ash, Siberian elm, five species of maple, and two species of basswood, Russian olive, Norway poplar. I mean, there's a lot of different, and then tons of firs and different firs and pines.
Yeah, so, that's a broad list of species.
It is.
Basswood, surprising to me. Yeah.
It kind of blew me out. It really did surprise me.
That's a good carving wood, isn't it, basswood?
Very soft wood, yep.
Yeah. Now, I imagine, correct me if I'm wrong, but trees being long-lived and slow to propagate, there's not as much concern about them being invasive as with, say, orange hawkweed, maybe.
It depends on your time scale. I mean, the oldest lodgepole I was able to find on the Kenai was actually grown by a homesteader out near Strawberry Road out there. And after the 69 burn, which, of course, was a big burn here on the Kenai, and there were a lot of fuel breaks put in, those are the first records I know of lodgepole pine being planted. So they're already, you know, 50 years old. And the picture she showed me, I mean, they were, you know, 70-foot tall trees, and I'm sure they have propagules down there. So.
Sure. I know I believe it's the Department of Agriculture, you'd probably know, John, that they maintain a list of trees and shrubs that are invasive in Alaska. So certainly they've seen, however you quantify invasiveness, you know, trees that have shown those, exhibited those traits and are listed as such. So it's certainly a consideration for people when they do a planting.
Mm-hmm. Well, the two that, you know, I mentioned in the article that, and one I actually just looked up, and that's the you know, what people call the bird cherry or the is it Mayday?
Mayday bird cherry.
Mayday bird cherry. You know, and that was actually banned by ordinance in Anchorage last fall, sometime I think in August. And they actually banned it from selling it in Anchorage. And that's because it kills moose.
Oh, really? Which one is this?
It's Prunus patus. It's what people call the bird cherry.
Oh, okay.
And it's actually all over town. And in the spring, it has wonderful white flowers that you can see it. But the problem is inside the bark and the foliage, it has cyanide. And basically, in the wintertime, when moose start feeding on it, what it does is it tends to grow along the stream bottoms, like up in Anchorage, it's in the Campbell Creek Valley or Creek watershed. And in those kinds of areas where moose start stripping it down, they can start accumulating it to the point where they die. And there's been a few documented cases up there by ADF&G.
No kidding.
Yeah.
Wow. You know, I always thought that, because I knew we had some sort of hemlock in Alaska, I always thought, you know...
Oh, you're thinking of the Hemlock Society.
Yeah, or Socrates, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
Or was it Plato?
That's
I can't remember.
Hemlock, I
yeah. I thought, oh, man, it's going to kill all the moose. But apparently not. It's this one here. So I know we have these here, right?
Yeah, yeah. They're actually fairly common in the town of Soldotna. I confess, I had one growing in my yard, and it grew really quickly, and then I had a pang of guilt, and I, you know, cut it down and got rid of it. But at any rate, yeah.
Do we have to worry about? Any of these trees going wild and becoming invasive and doing something like wiping out the moose? And if so, over what kind of time frame?
Well, that's a good question. The time frame is the issue. In one sense, I would argue that, especially with climate warming, I would argue that everything is invasive to a certain extent. Just give it enough time and it will spread. But, of course, a lot of times when we talk about true invasiveness, that means an undisturbed habitat, right? So you would actually, and most of the species that we have growing here, I would not consider invasive in that context. But the like they mentioned specifically the Amur maple, which is an Asian maple, and that's growing. It's growing out here. I know for sure it's growing in Sterling. I think it's growing in town. There's some very large trees of it in Seward. And down in the Midwest, in Minnesota, that's considered an invasive species because, you know, it produces those winged samaras.
Oh, uh-huh.
And it, you know, kicks it out and the wind catches it and moves it out into, disturbed soil. And the thing that we have here, and coming back to things like spruce bark beetle and fire, is that's what creates, you know, your opening for some of these plants to get established.
And so... we're not worried about these things becoming invasive. Or, I mean, like horribly invasive, something that, you know, is an emergency.
I think John's point is that, as a landowner, if you're going to plant these, you should do some due diligence. And we have seen things like Siberian larch and lodgepole pine certainly invade on disturbed sites, you know, which disturbed sites are pretty common in Alaska with a lot of the, you know, heavy equipment use we have and things like that. So, you know, be aware of the surroundings and do some research prior to planting it, you know, whatever you're planting.
Mm-hmm. I kind of get the feeling, though, that sort of what you're saying was that if climate change continues and warming continues, that one of these days it won't matter. That the plants are going to change anyway. The foliage here is going to be different someday in the future anyway.
I think to a certain extent that is what I'm saying. And then what man is doing is giving choices to the environment to pick. And so that's why we need to give some thought to what species we're going to plant here. So putting bird cherry here probably isn't real smart if we care about our moose, right? And putting amber maple and Asian maple may not be the best idea in the world since it spreads. It's a choice, and a really good example is pike, okay? I mean, if I'm going to go back to what I know, fish and wildlife type stuff. And, you know, pike is native to Alaska, but not native to the Kenai. And ADF&G, bless their heart, they're absolutely right, has made the choice that, we don't need to have pike on the Kenai. We don't need to have it. It's a choice, right? And I think that's... That's what you were speaking to, Hans, is that
correct.
We have choice. We have to do due diligence, and we shouldn't be planting things that we know are not good.
Yeah, I would agree. I think, it's up to, it kind of ties into the defensible space piece, right, as far as private land responsibility. You know, you have as a forester, I see, individuals have an obligation to, whether you have a quarter acre or 40 acres, to manage that forest and to make defensible space around your infrastructure, and also, make smart choices regarding what you're planting and the chances for them to potentially become invasive at some point.
Mm-hmm. Do you guys look into the future much, just thinking about these things? 100 years from now, once you're long gone or long retired?
I don't spend a lot of time thinking 100 years in the future, but I think, from my standpoint, that like any resource management issue, it's not so much land management as it is people management, and that'll be the big change on the Kenai, certainly 100 years from now, as we're seeing more and more and more people on the Kenai Peninsula, which changes the environment. And as, to John's point of, creates more inputs for, the environment to decide which is what it's going to accept. So I think that'll be the biggest change, obviously, to the Kenai in the near and long term.
Yeah, in my case, on my staff, we do a lot of climate modeling, and we do look at a lot of climate data. And in fact, we're doing a couple of things that you might be interested in. One is I have a grad student at Michigan State right now. She's working on her doctorate, and one of the things she's exploring is what would be the thought process if we wanted to bring new species to the Kenai? What would that look like? And so she's kind of going through that process of thinking, and it's a tough thing to do because it kind of breaks with a lot of our the way that Hans and I, when we went to school, I'm a little bit older than Hans here, but I think he's got the same kind of formal background. We have perceptions of what is nature and what is natural, right? And that's a tough thing to shake. But in a climate-changing world that's, primarily human-driven, it kind of shakes the kind of foundation of what we think of as a good place to be. So she's kind of exploring what would that look like if we decided to bring new species here. And in fact, one of the projects that we're working on right now with her is we're doing what we call common gardens. We're actually planting. We're getting ready to plant some trees that we, obviously we're deliberately picking trees that we don't think are injurious or or invasive, but we're actually going to be looking at different trees that could grow here.
Wow. Now, when your grad student talking about species, only plant species.
Well, we're actually thinking, and of course, this is all an intellectual exercise at this point, but we're also thinking about wildlife as well.
Mm-hmm. Huh. Down in Kodiak, an aside about introducing species, pretty much every animal there except for bears have been introduced.
That's right, every mammal. Even the snowshoe hares have been introduced.
Yeah.
And the elk and the deer and the goats and...
Reindeer?
Reindeer, the whole bit. Everything there is introduced.
Yeah. It's kind of bears, long-tailed weasels, and little brown bats, I think, are the only indigenous mammals there.
Well, that's right. And I had an interesting interaction with a grad student two or three years ago who actually went down there to study that assemblage of mammals. I mean, you might have even met the guy. I'm trying to remember his name. But at any rate, he was looking at it from the perspective of the fact that these are an invasive species assemblage, right? And I kind of said, well, maybe... Maybe you ought to think of it a different way. Maybe you should think of this as a big experiment in climate adaptation and put a different spin on it. And, it's not that, and it comes down to your values and what you're trying to promote.
Oh, yeah. Also, cattle and bison.
Yeah. Yep.
And, I don't know, hoary marmots, and they're all over the place.
There's a that's an island that was cut off, and if you had left it the way it was, you'd pretty much have brown bears and salmon and...
Yeah.
That would have been it.
It's 10:30. We traditionally take a little break here to refill our coffee cups and reset, and I think we are going to do that now. You're listening to the Kenai Conversation. I'm your host, Jay Barrett. We're talking about trees and the forests and the critters that live in them with the people who, well, as we heard, manage the people who go into the forest. We have Hans Rinke with the state, and we have John Morton with the refuge. And we're going to be back in about 5 minutes. It is 10:34, and you're listening to the Kenai Conversation here on KDLL 91.9 FM, Kenai Soldotna. We are talking about the forests and the trees, and I've got a couple of experts in the room to help us navigate our way through the trees. Hans Rinke with the state and John Morton with the refuge. Before we jump into other things, I want to mention that tomorrow at this time, we will be off the air because they're working on our studio to transmitter tower link. So between 10 and 4 tomorrow, we'll be off the air. But you can listen to us online at kdll.org. It'll make our signal better and everybody will be happier. So, gentlemen, we were talking earlier. Oh, wait, one other thing I want to add is we have a phone line. And if folks would like to call in, it's 283-8414. If you have questions about the forest and or trees in general, they probably don't have growing advice for your apple tree. I don't know. Maybe they do.
No.
I guess we'll find out. But more about the forest out here and the refuge and the forest fires. And right now, we're going to talk about spruce bark beetles. Who wants to tackle the evil spruce bark beetle first? Hans, how about you?
Sure.
Said you said you go out and do an annual survey.
Yeah, you bet. I'll tackle that. And first, I'll tackle them by saying they're, you know, they're not evil. They're a native forest insect here that have evolved with, you know, white spruce species for as long as white spruce has been around, I'd imagine. So they're a native insect here to the Kenai and to the boreal forest. And the survey you talked about was the state, in conjunction with the U.S. Forest Service, every year flies a aerial detection survey, and that includes, I believe, at some points, John, Fish and Wildlife Service staff, entomologists, but they essentially fly transects and fixed-wing aircraft around, obviously not the entire state of Alaska, but different portions of the state of Alaska, and so from that comes data. They type different kinds of insect or disease issues they see from the air based on the foliage. And so from that typing, we get an idea of what's going on the ground, then that's ground truth to determine the extent and if the original typing was correct. So in the last 3 or 4 years, we've seen an increase in spruce bark beetle numbers. In south central Alaska, you know, the last year's number was about 400,000 acres affected by spruce bark beetle. That doesn't mean there's 400,000 acres of 100% dead spruce trees. That means on 400,000 acres, some of those trees have spruce bark beetle. The majority of that activity is in the Susitna Valley, across Cook Inlet from us in the Matsu Valley. You know, that estimated acreage here in the Kenai and is around 50,000 acres or so of spruce bark beetle activity. This is mostly centrally located, you know, around Nikiski on the northern part of the Kenai Peninsula. You know, this last year's flight, we did see some scattered pockets of spruce beetle activity in Kenai, Soldotna, and Kasilof, and that's kind of the telltale. You see these islands developing of spruce bark beetle, and, you know, my trajectory would be that you know, we'll see those expand. So we'll see expanded spruce bark beetle trees showing up in the kind of central Kenai Peninsula.
Now, as I recall from I did, like every reporter 20 years ago here in Kenai,
sure,
we did stories about these things kind of ad nauseum. As I recall, the beetles prefer a tree of a certain diameter.
Correct.
And so maybe the slight pause is because those trees were in short supply, and now maybe they've grown and they're on the upswing again, or are there other factors?
It's probably hard to tell, but there's two driving factors for when you see an increase in bark beetle activity, and this would be whether it's pine beetle or spruce bark beetle, and that's, you know, available food source and temperature. So when you have an available food source, which they prefer larger diameter trees, which have a thicker phloem, a thicker inner bark, and then warming temperatures, which can lead to they can accelerate their life cycle with warmer temperatures. So cooler temperatures, it's a 2-year life cycle. With warmer temperatures, they can cut that down to a year. So those are the two factors you kind of need to have an increase in bark beetle activity.
Oh, and what have you, what have the experts seen in the last few years that have, that might account for the blooms?
We've certainly seen a increase, you know, in warming the last few years, you know, not specifically last summer, but, you know, the previous summers before that, we saw an increase in the duration of warm days and warmer days. And then also, you know, where the spruce bark beetle, where the density of the population is now in the northern Kenai was an area that for reasons unknown to me, you know, didn't have a lot of damage, you know, the last go around. So it has a number of larger diameter trees, which would be a suitable host.
Ah, you know, I was going to ask if Nikiski was kind of spared last time.
Yeah, to what I've read and what I've seen on maps, it somewhat was. And I don't know the reasons for that, but
John, I think in that instance it kind of just petered out, as you know, because the epicenter for the beetle outbreak that started in the 80s was, of course, Caribou Hills, and that down there was almost 100% tree mortality over a big section of the southern part of the peninsula.
Yes.
And then, you know, from there basically spread north, and I think basically it ran out of steam about the time it was starting to get to the central peninsula. And so what we're seeing now is kind of finishing up the northern portion of the peninsula from here on up.
With warming temperatures, perhaps.
Yeah, and, you know, Ed Berg is the guy, he used to be on my staff. He was a very, very knowledgeable ecologist. And, in fact, I'll put a plug in that he's around this summer. He lives in Mexico. He's retired now. He lives in Mexico in the winter months, but he's back now, and he'd be an incredible guy to get here on your show. He can talk about just about anything. But at any rate, at the end of the day, he showed that the historical rate of spruce bark beetle outbreaks is basically about every 50 years. And what triggers it is two consecutive summers of above average temperatures. And in the case of the big outbreak in the 80s, what set that off was, you know, obviously we had multiple years of above average temperatures, and that kind of just set it up to run for about 15 years, yeah. Right?
Yep.
Huh. Now, Hans, you said something that surprised me, that the spruce bark beetle was endemic to the forest, to those trees.
Correct.
I was surprised by that. For some reason, I had it in my head that they came in from somewhere else, like China or something.
No, they're a native forest insect. So they've evolved here for, you know, millennium, certainly, along with the tree species to eventually rejuvenate those tree species, right? So, you know, you see tying to the fire ecology, you see these spruce trees impacted by spruce bark beetle, you know, die, eventually fall over, eventually burn, and eventually repopulated by potentially spruce trees at some point. That stand will eventually become spruce trees again at some point.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. I mean, the way to think of it is just, you know, it's a natural disturbance. It's a culling action. But again, the thing that was different here in the 90s is the length of time that 80s and going into mid 90s, it was the length of time that it ran. You know, for consecutive years. And then, like I say, it was like 100% tree mortality on the Homer Bench area.
I remember seeing whole hillsides, just that sort of orangish red burgundy color of those trees down there, of the needles, at that time.
Yeah, Ed Berg tells a story of and he says it's just pure luck that the of a big swarm that was actually seen leaving Homer and headed across Kachemak Bay, and it just happened to be a big wind event, actually blew them back. And he actually thinks that's what kind of, even though there ultimately was beetle kill on the other side of Kachemak Bay, it was not the, you know, the heavy mortality that you saw on the Homer side.
Yeah, interesting.
More of a traditional culling action over there.
Right. Are there spruce bark beetles? Are there bark beetles for every kind of tree? I mean, for the black spruce that are out there on the tundra, or the Sitka spruce that are, you know, down on the Cross Kachemak Bay, or
there are. You'll see spruce beetle in Sitka spruce. They don't have the high as high of mortalities in white spruce or the Lutz spruce, the hybrid spruce we have here in portions of the Kenai here, but. Certainly, yeah, every tree has its insect or host of insects. Ips beetles are another beetle you see a lot of here in the Kenai Peninsula, a smaller beetle than spruce bark beetle, but like the clearing along the Sterling Highway that you see going south of Soldotna, there's dead trees along the edge of that clearing. Those are from ips beetles, so ips are attracted to slash, recent slash, mostly small diameter, and in some cases they'll infest trees next to that slash. Similar to spruce bark beetle, if you have firewood with spruce bark beetle in it and stack it next to a spruce tree, it'll infest your spruce tree. Same with ips beetle. So, yeah, it's anytime you peel back the bark of a tree when it's dead and you find those galleries, those little tunnels in there, right? That's from a bark beetle of a boring bark beetle of some kind.
Right. Well, and just to be clear, our native spruce bark beetle, it typically does not affect black spruce, but it does affect Sitka, it does affect white, and it does affect the Lutz spruce, which is the hybrid between Sitka and white. And then the other thing that, and this is an Asian one, is the spruce aphid, right, down in Homer.
Correct, yeah, the last, with the exception of this year, the last few years, we've had, European spruce aphid in most of Homer proper, eating the needles of Sitka spruce.
So, no kidding.
Yeah. And that affected something like 15,000 acres in the two previous years.
Huh. I haven't heard about that one. Huh. I was going to ask about life cycle of these bugs, or the beetles. When they're kind of dormant, are they still? What's the difference between a bloom of infestation like you're seeing now, and when there kind of wasn't much going on a couple of years ago?
Sure.
In like numbers.
When there wasn't much going on, the way that the spruce beetle is perpetuating its population is, it's finding their preferred food of choice is a damaged spruce tree. So they can smell that spruce tree, the terpenes in that tree, basically what you think of as smelling like a Christmas tree. Those spruce beetles can smell and find that. So they would, they would come out in May or June out of the tree. They would find the tree with a broken top from a previous year, a tree that's blown over, and they would infest that tree. Carry out their life cycle the next year, come out, may or may not find a suitable host, depending on if there's any damaged trees in the vicinity. But that's basically how they maintain their population at that endemic level, that they just find those damaged trees. And you can see that, if you look for damaged trees around, you can certainly see them in there, prior to the last few years with increased activity.
But there has to be a triggering event, like two very warm, I'm sorry, did you say winters or summers?
Yeah, no, it was actually two consecutive summers.
Summers.
That's what keeps it fired up.
Yeah, and when that happens, then they go crazy.
Yeah, and the way Ed figured this out is he looked at tree ring data, and what happens is when the beetle comes in and basically culls the forest, right, it's essentially releasing trees in the understory. And so the trees that are in the understory grow better, and so they have bigger tree rings. And what he was able to do is statistically take a look at tree ring measurements, and that's how he showed that, for at least the last several hundred years, basically, you get a beetle kill every 50 years.
Oh, right.
And you can tell by the tree rings.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. Yeah, you need those warm temperatures and that available large, you know, available, just like John said, those larger diameter trees, available food source.
The piece that's kind of interesting that we're kind of poking around, lots of old-time foresters here have commented that the reason why it was so, the beetle kill was so devastating down the Caribou Hills area is because that area is historically, the perception is that was Lutz spruce, which is the hybrid. And a guy up at UAF who's now long since retired, but a fellow named John Alden, who's a very knowledgeable person about this kind of stuff, he actually thought that Lutz, the hybrid, was more intolerant of spruce bark beetle. And that's why you got that massive die-off there. So one of the things we're working on right now is we're working with a woman named Diana Wolf, who's a geneticist up at UAF, and we've sent her a lot of specimens. And what we're trying to do is map the distribution of white Sitka and specifically Lutz. We're trying to figure out where Lutz is, so because we're pretty sure this is what is the big mortality here that's going on.
Interesting,
huh? That is. As I recall, the spruce bark beetle outbreak 20 years ago when I first moved here coincided with the Firewise program. You know, I imagine trees killed by beetles are more apt to catch fire. No?
Where that a lot of that information is coming from is the pine bark beetle, where they've associated down in the south. I think it's Ponderosa. Is that right?
Yep, Lodgepole and Ponderosa.
Yeah, where they've associated beetle kill with fire, but up here, I don't see quite that same linkage. I mean, I think there is a very small window when, after the trees have been infested and they're actually dead, where the needles go, it takes a couple of years for the needles to drop off. And I think there is a period there where it's fairly flammable. But the real issue here with beetle is that after we've seen, particularly areas where lots of beetle have, where lots of spruce have died, is the grass comes back in. It's the grass that's the real danger here.
Yeah, I would agree. We've seen that. In a season or two, when those red needles have fallen off and those fine twigs have fallen off, the tree certainly is less flammable than when it was green. But with that lack of shading to the understory, you see an increase in that grass, which is more flammable. And then those standing trees present a safety hazard to personnel. Certainly standing snags within that fire are a safety hazard to personnel entering fires to suppress fires. And that's a certainly a growing issue in the lower 48, where we've seen these large, massive, you know, bark beetle outbreaks, and is here as well.
Well, and that kind of takes us full circle back to the original reason why state forestry was originally planting, you know, promoting the planting of non-native trees in the, you know, wildland-urban interface, right, where grass was appearing in some of these areas. And the issue there is, you know, if you plant spruce, it'll probably get impacted by spruce bark beetle again, our native spruce. So the idea there, and correct me if I'm wrong, Hans, was to, you know, get non-native trees. And the non-native trees have burn cycles too. The difference is they have burn cycles that are, you know, decades, if not longer, you know, several decades, whereas grass burns conceivably, you know, every few years and possibly every year.
Correct. Yeah, that's excellent point that you've seen a reduction in that grass certainly here with plantings on parts of the Kenai, and some of these commercial scale plantings were done post harvest. You certainly see a reduction of grass now where there's regeneration that's 16 or 20 feet tall. You know, it's turning into more of a traditional boreal forest ground cover, which is, you know, much less flammable than our native grass here. So
yeah, that's one of the fingerprints of a warming climate. You know, I sat in a year or so ago, I was sitting in on, and I know you were involved, Hans, I sat in on a telecon with a bunch of foresters around the state who were kind of looking at restocking rates.
Correct. Yeah.
And I remember the conversation they were having in Fairbanks kind of really surprised me. They're seeing the same kind of climate signal in Fairbanks. And the point that they made is that when you go in and you cut softwood up there, what you get back is hardwood. And when you cut hardwood, what you get back is grass. That's how much it's warming. And when I say grass, we're talking about Calamagrostis canadensis. But, right. But that's what you get back. I mean, the system is changing that much now.
Huh. You know, I think it was, Edberg?
Yeah.
Mentioned? You know, you're talking about the changes in the ground. I think I interviewed him once about the disappearance of ponds on the Kenai Peninsula.
Yeah, drying wetlands.
Yeah, drying wetlands. And I think it had to do with the rebound effect from the last glaciation, maybe. It was a long time ago. I don't remember the details of every story I've ever written, but I remember interviewing him about that and how they're kind of drying up. And, you know, when you fly to Anchorage, you could see, you know, where the ponds used to be and how they're shrinking.
Right. And, you know, in the forestry world, you call that afforestation, when you have trees growing in places they've never grown before. And what the case that Ed makes is that, you know, we have these historical peatlands, you know, which are sphagnum moss, and we know that they've been there for, you know, 8,000 years plus. And the reason we know that is because you can core and, you know, look at pollen records and things like that, and you can tell that it's been sphagnum for literally 8,000 years, right? And then in more recent times, on the very tops of these cores now, starting about 70 years ago, and kind of with a mean of about 35 years, you start getting encroachment of both woody shrubs and black spruce. So what's happening out in the, especially on the northern part of the peninsula, where we have these historical wetlands that used to serve as fire breaks, right? Natural fire breaks, they're starting to get forested. And so they're kind of a game changer in thinking about fire strategy.
Now that you mention that, John, you can certainly see that in a lot of black spruce, right? Muskeg edges, the creeping of the black spruce, right? Kind of creeping out into those muskegs.
Yeah. And so, you know, that we have the potential for bigger and more catastrophic fires on the northern part of the peninsula, which is one of the reasons why with the All Hands, All Lands group, and they're doing these strategic fuel breaks around communities, it's so critical. It really is for protecting the communities from burning down.
We have about 3 minutes left. Are there, what are the plans for the forest or our wildlands this year? Are there plans for, what are the plans for the forest or the wildlands out there?
You know, the plan for my agency will be, we'll be ready to respond to wildland fire as necessary here locally, and if not here locally, within the state or within the nation. That's our thrust, certainly, for the fire season. So that's what we're geared up to do, and that's what we'll be doing.
No prescribed burns?
We don't have any prescribed burns planned for this season. That's something here locally that we haven't had a lot of involvement in here, just due to the way the land ownership works here for the state of Alaska. But, you know, in other parts of the state, that's going on, and depending on resource availability, we may assist in some of those burns in other parts of the state.
John, what's going on over at the refuge?
Yeah, on our end, we're continuing with research. And, you know, I mentioned earlier some of the work that we're doing with the geneticist up at UAF to figure out where Lutz spruce is. Another one that we're kind of working on right now with some researchers in China is to look at, we have two species of birch here, trees, both the white birch that people are familiar with and then the Kenai birch. And we're actually exploring where those come from, you know, in the sense of how special are they. And we've already got enough information back now that we know that they're not related to the white birch on the East Coast. They're actually more related to the silver birch that's in Europe.
Interesting.
Which is kind of stunning. And it's an artifact of, you know, Beringia when we were connected.
Oh, right.
So there's some weird stuff here.
Man, give me a call when you find out something. Yep. We'll go on the air with that again, too. Well, gentlemen, I really appreciate you coming on and talking to me about trees and the forest and forest fires, wildland fires, spruce bark beetles, whole nine yards. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
I clearly called the right guys.
Really enjoyed it.
Yep, great time.
John Morton, Supervisory Fish and Wildlife Biologist with the Kenai National Wildlife Refuge, and Hans Rinke with the Kenai Kodiak, who is the Kenai Kodiak Area Forester with the State of Alaska Division of Forestry. Thank you both very much for coming by this morning.